If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I always say it's easy to go from 0 to 4, right? But if you're looking to go from 4 to 15, then A, you need solid A player team, but B, the less headaches, the faster and smoother you can go.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jimmy Edwards has 14 years of experience, including property valuation, underwriting, loan origination, rehab, asset management, finance, marketing, and sales. He's been buying distressed assets in Dallas-Fort Worth since 2011, has rehabbed and successfully sold over 100 single-family residences, and now is solely in the multifamily space. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Pleasure's all mine. The pleasure's all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on. Where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, 100%. I started as a real estate agent and then a loan originator. And then I started flipping houses in 2013, flipped over 100 properties. And then in 2017 was, you know, how do I scale this business? Do I buy more houses? Do I do bigger houses? Do I build new houses? And then I discovered multifamily and said, hey, you know, this looks like the best way to scale. So kind of moved in that direction into 2017, went all in 2018, and I've been here since.
What were some of the challenges that you faced in the single family flipping side that you wanted to solve by going into multifamily?
A couple of things. I think, you know, most importantly, you know, there's nobody covering your nut. So when your house is sitting there, when you're rehabbing it, flipping it, because I was mainly a flipper. I mean, I had a small portfolio of rentals, but, you know, in the flips, if somebody got a flat tire and your project was on hold for a week, you know, you're eating that interest. And multifamily, you know, you can rehab, you know, if you got a 100 unit deal, you can rehab 1, 2, 3, 4 units, and it's not digging into the red into your cash flow. So that was really the most attractive kind of turn of events. We had one property that, you know, 10 flips came on the market the same weekend and it just killed everyone. And so we kind of, you know, at that point said, hey, let's go this direction.
When you say 10 flips came on the market, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So we bought a house in a subdivision with really, really good comps, and we flipped it and we had overages in the budget. It took a little longer than expected. And then when we went to market, put it on the MLS, there was, you know, a half a dozen, I said 10, but, you know, at least half a dozen properties that came on the market around the same week. And so it's kind of saturated the subdivision. And what ended up happening is there was a lot of inventory and, you know, a couple of the guys started dropping their prices pretty drastically. And so it was kind of like a competition to whoever could, you know, lower their price the most and sell the quickest. We kind of held our ground. Other inventory started selling. And, you know, we sat on the market much longer than our typical timeline, and it really ate into our holding costs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things going on there. Ate into your holding costs. You've probably got capital deployed that you can't redeploy into the next project. And this was in 2017 where, you know, everybody's talking about, okay, you know, when are we going to see asset prices decline? You know, I think there was a lot more pressure than on the sell side than what we have now.
Right.
So that's very interesting. What was your transition like when you went from single family to multifamily, and how did you find your you know, strategy and partners, and just walk us through that process?
Sure. Yeah. So my current partner, Catherine, we've been together since like 2013. She's kind of construction management leg, and I'm really, you know, acquisitions. And so it was a really good fit. I was kind of doing things by myself before we teamed up. I had a couple different partners going, but I found a lot of shared alignment with her. And so we kind of picked up and started moving this conveyor belt. She had been in the multifamily space prior to that, doing due diligence locally here in DFW with a couple, you know, mentorship groups and other buyer groups. And so when we kind of decided to make the transition, we plugged back into that ecosystem. And, you know, we started looking at smaller deals. My, you know, as luck would have it, my neighbor, I sold his house a couple years back wearing my realtor hat. And he called me up. He moved to Miami and he called me up and he said, "Hey man, you want to buy my 26 unit building?" And I was like, matter of fact, I do. So we took a run at that and, you know, we learned a lot. We learned, you know, A, that, you know, on that deal, you had to self-manage it to make the numbers work. And we learned, you know, obviously we didn't want to do that and lenders didn't like you to do that. We also learned about, you know, balance sheet and net worth and a lot of other, you know, things that we didn't really know about. And I think the biggest takeaway was, you know, it's easier to do a bigger deal than it is to do a smaller deal. And so it was really a mindset shift for me of, you know, let's take down this 26 unit deal ourselves, but it was actually more challenging than it would be to take down a 100 unit deal with a couple other people. So, I mean, that was really a learning experience. And I think, you know, my biggest takeaway was just, you know, get going and, you know, and go big.
Yeah, that's a painful lesson I think a lot of us have encountered. And I can even just testify on this side of things. There's a project that took on last year that is taking longer and more work, and it's a smaller project than the 246 units we just closed on. It's like, wait, this was way harder. It still is way, it's still a thorn in my side. And I'm like, yes. Oh my gosh, why did I do this to myself? And it's, you know, 1/10 the size of the deal we just closed. Far easier.
Yeah.
The big one was far easier. You hit on a few things there that I'd like to kind of circle back on. One is you said that self-manage, you know, the property was too small to have a property management come in. So you decided to self-manage it, but the lenders didn't like that. What does that mean?
So it was interesting. I, you know, I'd had a dozen, half a dozen single family rentals at the time, whether they were, you know, flips or rentals that I was holding. You know, I'd been on title to over 100 houses. And, you know, I came into this thinking, hey, you know, I've got tons of experience. And we went to the lender and, you know, their first question was, you know, what kind of multifamily experience do you have? And I was like, I don't have any, but here's my resume. And they're like, well, that doesn't really matter. And so even though I'd self-managed all my single family rentals, you know, it was not acceptable for them to self-manage the 26 unit property. And it's actually kind of a blessing in disguise because, you know, had we taken that on, it would have sucked all of our time and we wouldn't have been able to go after the next deal. So, yeah.
So as it is, you guys ended up not closing on the 26 unit because of the hurdles.
Correct. We didn't buy that one, but we did. We learned a lot and we ended up buying a 16 unit deal. And it was, I mean, I say it was an F, 20 year owner. You know, we took it from an F to C plus, rents from 550 to 1150. I mean, it was a full reposition, all new tenants. And like you said, it was a big, heavy lift. But the lesson learned was we baked in third party management on that deal. And it was a game changer. Because we ended up buying a 100 unit deal 90 days later. Had we been self-managing, that never would have happened.
Right. I think that's brilliant because you would have had you'd have been buried in the weeds.
Yes.
Dealing with managing a 16 unit property and just getting that thing going and would have totally missed a 100 unit deal.
100%. Wow. Yeah. Might have been buried in the backyard with those tenants, but
you still own the 16 unit.
We sold it. We actually closed that one April 2020. So in the middle of COVID, sold it. We did a reverse 1031. So actually moved that money into a 120 unit deal. So it's been a good play. You know, I'm the smaller deals like we talked about are a bit of headache, but they also have, you know, tremendous value if you can, you know, turn a little bit of money into a lot of money with the 1031.
Yeah. You used a term I've not heard before. You said reverse 1031. What's that mean?
So we bought the up leg before we closed the down leg. So we bought the 120 unit deal in November of 2019. And basically what we did was we covered the equity out of pocket. And then when we sold the down leg, we got reimbursed. So
I guess I didn't realize that was a possibility. I guess you're telling me it is. So
yeah,
clearly it is a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. So my goal was to close both of them simultaneously, but as luck would have it, it was much harder to get a 16 unit deal closed than it was a 120 unit deal. So we went ahead and closed 120 and we actually bridged some of that gap. The lender let us pull some equity out of the smaller deal. So we pulled some of our equity out, and then we gathered up some of our funds. We put the down payment on the 120 unit deal. And then when the 16 unit deal sold, it did, you know, it all went through the intermediary, reverse 1031 exchange company. But once the 16 unit sold, that equity was realized, moved over into the 120 unit deal. And then we got paid back what we put down. So we basically just had to front the equity, and then it got swapped out.
Right, right. And because, and I'm assuming if you were just fronting the equity, and all you're doing is obviously you're just swapping, you know, paper from one company to the next, and it ends up right back in your account, the place it started, but you couldn't sell it. This is where I'm getting crazy thoughts here, but you couldn't sell it to yourself or to your 1031 for more than you paid for it initially, the 120 unit. Say you paid, we're just throwing numbers out here, $10 million for the 120 unit, right?
Right.
You couldn't then turn around and 1031 that back to yourself for $11 million.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That's very creative and I like that, but I'm not exactly sure. I know that it stayed in the 1031 company, you know, the entire time of the transition. So I'm not exactly sure.
Right. No. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm probably getting into the weeds there. I'm just thinking creative ways that you can, you know, if you're in a situation where you might end up with, you know, a need to move more money, I don't know, and do an asset, maybe, you know, could appraise for more or something like that, then there might be a way to kind of do that backwards if you needed to, for whatever reason. I don't know what that reason would be. Again, anyway, I'm in the weeds here. Clever. So talk to us about, you know, I know you said that, you know, you I think Catherine, you said is your business partner.
Yeah, we have a couple of different, you know, co-GPs on several different deals, but my main partner is Catherine. We've been together since 2013, and we're, like I said, she has got a lot of construction management experience. And then, you know, I really kind of focus on the acquisitions part of things. I mean, I think it's obviously what I enjoy. Like I like chasing deals. I like putting deals together. You know, the minutiae isn't exactly, you know, what I think is fun. You know, there's other people that, you know, would hate what I do and enjoy that more. So we've really found kind of, you know, a groove, and it's been working well. So we're, you know, I think kind of we've hired an analyst to help underwrite deals, because again, data entry, you know, not something I love doing. And then I think kind of our next step is hiring an executive assistant. You know, we tend to pass minutia back and forth, and I think it's time to, you know, get someone that, you know, really enjoys being a desk jockey so that it can help us grow. So
yeah, and you know, somebody that is administratively minded.
100%. I can do it. I can learn anything. We're smart people, but I feel like there's a cloud over my head when I'm, you know, sitting there building spreadsheets. Like it's just, you know, it's not fun to me.
Yeah, it's not fun. And again, it goes back to the 16 unit deal versus the 120 unit deal or whatever the number was.
Right.
You know, if you were heads down building a spreadsheet, groaning about, gosh, I hate what I'm doing right now, there's no way you're going to have the creative energy or the a desire, you know, to turn around and be like, oh yeah, hey, look at that deal. You're just pissed off because you're sitting there doing something you hate.
Right. So, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Farm that out. Get people on your team. And that's something I think we hear over and over in this business, is that you've got a, who is it that, I forget, I think it's Hunter Thompson. He said, man, I've got very few strengths. So all I do is use the couple strengths I have and let everybody else fill in the gaps. Because
I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So good for you. So what's your buy box look like now?
Really, you know, and again, it comes from learning, and it's all a part of the growth pattern. I think, you know, we're searching for, you know, 150 to 300 unit deals, 1980s or newer, preferably, you know, looking to move into B class. You know, historically, we've bought C's. You know, when we started buying in 17 and 18, the cap rate difference was probably wider than it is now. You know, we've had some older properties with chillers, and we've had several all bills paid properties. And, you know, there's some, you know, just, it's just a different asset class. Right. And historically you get better, you know, better returns, risk reward. But I think we're seeing a lot of cap rate compression, and, you know, the difference between an A, even an A and a C is, you know, not that much. So we're really, you know, looking around that $15 to $25 million mark, 150 to, you know, I say 300 units, you know, 1980s or newer, DFW, Houston, San Antonio. We've still got some assets in Lubbock. I like like that market. It's a little bit slower growth, but you know, the cash flow is good. So yeah, just Texas bound, you know, we're born and raised Texans, true and true. So, you know, we like to buy here.
No, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Why are you moving from C's to A's just from an ease of management perspective? Or, I mean, oh, you said
capital. Yeah, I mean, I think that really in the B-class product, you're just going to have less headaches altogether. You know, your tenant base, you know, you would think is a little bit stronger. You know, like we just had a storm in San Antonio. And power went out in a whole building. It was built in the 60s. It's been completely remodeled. You know, historically, we don't have any issues there. But the storm shot, you know, we just got a bid for 26 panels. We got a whole building out, 26 panels. You know, that could happen on any product, right? But, you know, it seems as you move down the road, some of the older product tends to have a little bit more issues that come up from time to time, you know. So it's not, I think that, you know, in order to scale, look, like, you know, I always say it's easy to go from 0 to 4, right? But if you're looking to go from 4 to 15, then, you know, A, you need a solid A player team, but B, you know, the less headaches, the faster and smoother you can go. So, you know, if you've got 15 C-minus products, like you're going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to come up, you know, and it's not all, you know, it could be property specific. It could be, you know, tenant base. I mean, I tend to believe that, you know, neighbors fight more often in a C-minus property than in a B-plus. So you end up getting kind of in the weeds. And sometimes, you know, your third party management is should be handling it, but it still can be a distraction, right? So, you know, if I'm jumping on a call today to talk about, you know, a $39,000 bid that came out of left field Sunday night, like that's taken me away from really digging into the analysis of a 288 unit acquisition, right? So it's just not necessarily something that is my day-to-day operations, but it's something that, you know, we got to discuss as a team.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And again, it goes back to refining what you focus on and find the highest and best use of your time. Talk to us a little bit about your finances, if you can. How have you financed your deals? How have you raised capital? What does that look like?
Sure, sure. So typically probably 3 out of the 4 deals, we have used bank loans. And that was really, you know, the first deal we bought, I told, you know, 16 unit reposition. Second deal was 50 person occupied. So 100 unit deal, had 50 vacants, had to get bank loan for that. Third deal, we did a Freddie. And then the fourth deal was Shoebox Financials. So we went back to a bank on a handshake relationship. Seller owned that property for 20 years. And, you know, they didn't have computers, right? So I showed up and he handed me a briefcase, and it was, they thought they were organized, but to me, it was pretty archaic. So, and it was one of those things where, you know, I got a good price because the financing was going to be difficult. And when we went to the bank and they said, hey, do you have XYZ? And I said, it doesn't exist, but I can build it for you. And they looked back at us and they're like, no, it's okay. No worries. And they felt good about us and they felt good about the deal because I'd negotiated a good price based on the lack of information. So, but that really started, and again, it goes back to that 26 unit deal, right? Like we were looking at this deal and we were running comps and we knew an owner of a nearby property, called him to ask him some details, didn't end up buying that 26 unit deal. A couple months later, he called us, said, hey, by the way, you know, I know you guys are looking at stuff. I've got a deal, which was a 16 unit. You know, if you guys want a partner, it'll give you an opportunity to get into the space, but it'll also relieve me from, you know, a heavy lift. So it was a good match. So I've really, and then we ended up buying the next deal together and the next deal together. So it was really one of those things where, you know, you kind of found a match of people with experience, but maybe didn't have the time or the want to put in the sweat equity. Whereas, you know, we were just getting started and that was really attractive to us. Hey, we got somebody that's got a banking relationship, you know, has a good balance sheet, has a taste and a thirst for deals, can also provide some guidance, and we can come in and really do the heavy lift. So it was a really good fit. First couple, you know, that deal we funded ourselves. We had two syndications, and we just, you know, we over the past couple of years have been building our network and going to events and, you know, doing podcasts and being on Facebook groups. And, you know, we've got a pretty large database now. And so really just, you know, have building up an equity pool of, you know, people that are interested in passively investing. And, you know, over the years, those relationships have grown, right? And now, instead of raising $50,000 at a time, you know, we're raising $500,000 at a time, right? So the check writers have grown, and, you know, maybe, you know, you don't have to get as many people into the deals. I mean, I want everybody to get in our deals, right? Because I like making people money. But, you know, the ease of the transaction helps you go further.
Oh, yeah. I think you hit it on the head there. The fewer the investors are in any given deal, obviously the less maintenance and work there is for you as the sponsor.
For sure.
Just fewer people to communicate with, fewer calls, fewer webinars, fewer things like that. So I think just from a simplification standpoint, that makes all the sense in the world. Jimmy, let's jump here into the final four if we can. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Participate. Get started. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people have analysis paralysis, right? Like you're trying to, you know, make sure you have the money first, or make sure you have this relationship first, or this or that and the other. And I learned 10 years ago, and it's really something I say all the time. If you have a real deal, you'll find the money. You'll find people who want to deal with you, you know, but you got to get out there in the market and you have to participate, right? Like, we're going after deals and we might not win every one, but, you know, people know us, right? And so now I get those calls about deals that not necessarily coming to market, but might be a good fit for us, right? And so really just participating. I mean, that's my number one.
That's awesome. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Man, I hit the gym every morning. I'm up at 6:30. I'm in the gym. You know, I listen to podcasts. I try to listen to podcasts depending on my mood. You know, some days I'll knock out a podcast while I'm at the gym. And then some days I'm jamming out, but really just trying to get my day started. So I'm back in the office, 8:39, showered up, head right, you know, feeling good. And, you know, trying to absorb some knowledge at the same time.
Right. I love that. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
You know, that's a tough one for me, but just on a smaller scale, just trying to share knowledge and really just, you know, I come from a background, you know, pretty middle-class family, but, you know, I didn't plan on going to college. I ended up at college by sheer luck. And, you know, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad my senior year of college, and it completely changed my life. And so I really look at a lot of young folks and I see, you know, a lot of people would drive, but a lot of other people that, you know, they don't know what they don't know, which was kind of me. So really just trying to share with younger people, like, hey, man, you can have and do anything you want. Tools are out there. And sometimes they just need some guidance to see how to get started on that path.
Right, right. Man, that's super cool. Jimmy, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, come to our website. It's High Five Multifamily, HIGHFIVE, multifamily.com. There's an info form. Click it. We'll get back to you. Set up a call. Super simple.
Awesome. Jimmy, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.